2 per year. Again, robbery, except for trains and stagecoaches, was largely unknown. Still another researcher, examining Texas frontier towns from 1875 to 1900, found murder to be rare, not counting fair fights staged by gunslingers. Burglary and theft were so absent that people routinely did not lock their doors. Even in the California gold fields, with all its greed, researchers found little record of violence. For a brief time, it seemed as if the cattle frontier and the ubiquitous cowboys would never disappear. During the 1880s, the price of beef skyrocketed, and large European investment firms entered the market. In 1883, for example, Wyoming alone hosted 12 cattle firms with $12 million in assets. But because none of these cattlemen owned the land on which their cattle grazed, the public domain, none had much interest in taking care of it. By 1885, there were far too many cattle over-harvesting the grass of the public lands of the Great Plains. Tragically, the weather turned at the same time the cattle were short of feed. In the winter of 1886 to 87, temperatures plummeted to lows of minus 68 degrees Fahrenheit. Hundreds of thousands of cattle died of starvation, unable to graze the barren plains. The cowboy was usually the last in a line of characters to reach a town before civilization set in. Following the trappers, miners, soldiers, and missionaries, the cowboys inevitably gave way to the next wave of settlers, the farmers. The Homestead Act made available land in the form of 160-acre grants to 400,000 individuals and families from 1862 to 1890. Total improved acreage in the United States rose from 189 million to 414 million acres. And although the homestead grants were marked by fraud, the westward migration of legitimate farm families and the economic and environmental impact of that migration brought a staggering change to the demography and environment of the American West. In true frontier fashion, new Western farmers adapted to the semi-arid conditions that awaited most of them. New steel-bladed John Deere plows sliced through prairie soil that had lain dormant for centuries, and barbed wire, developed by John Warren Gates, became a standard fencing material on the treeless plains. Windmills pumped groundwater, and pioneers learned Mormon techniques for dry land farming and irrigation. Corn, wheat, and oat crops were complemented by alfalfa for winter feed for cattle and sheep herds. Then later, fruit, vegetables, potatoes, and sugar beets emerged as important crops in California, the Great Basin of Utah, and on the Columbia Plain. Yet frontier farmers found themselves pushed out by an emergent, highly industrialized agribusiness sector. For example, the typical farm size of 160 acres, a figure determined by unrealistic politicians in the lush eastern United States, was woefully inadequate to support plains agriculture. Drought, harsh winters, and competition from agribusiness combined to hurt small producers. Only capitalized firms could afford the equipment. Steam-powered tractors, combines, harvesters, and irrigation technology that characterized successful farming west of the Mississippi. The small farm in America truly died more than 100 years ago of its own inefficiency, when 2/3 of all homesteaders failed. Even when farming proved profitable, life on the frontier beat down the sodbusters, who got their name from breaking ground with their plows, and their families with periods of mind-numbing boredom mixed with near-death situations. Wild animals, poisonous reptiles, deadly diseases, drought, sub-zero cold, and blazing heat all combined to make prairie living exceedingly hard. Sodbusters had to ward off clouds of locusts, track down stray horses, keep their wells safe, and watch out for strangers or Indians. Their nearest neighbor might be miles away, and the closest town often a day or two's ride. Generally, a prairie family would purchase supplies for a month and might not see other humans for weeks. No one in a farm family had much leisure time. Farm life involved backbreaking work from well before sunrise until after sunset. Farmers often ate 5 hearty meals a day. They rose before sunup, ate an early dawn breakfast, took a mid-morning break for another small meal, returned at lunch, had a late afternoon snack, and then ate a full-scale dinner after sundown. That meant that wives spent virtually their entire lives cooking, cleaning up from one meal, then starting another. And cleaning in a house made of sod, dirt, itself constituted a monumental task. Despite low pay, sodbusters tried to hang on because of the independence farm life offered and the opportunity they had to own land. Nevertheless, most went broke, and those fortunate farmers who eventually did acquire their property after paying off the mortgage still faced problems. Seldom did crop prices increase enough for them to expand operations. But there had to be something to the appeal of farming. From 1860 to 1910, the number of farms in America tripled. This dynamic placed some 50 million people in an agricultural setting, cultivating 500 million acres, an area as large as Western Europe. Such farm sector expansion was accelerated by something as small as a sharp piece of wire sticking out from a twisted wire at regular intervals. Barbed wire. Joseph F. Glidden and Jacob Haish, 2 Illinois farmers, patented barbed wire in the mid-1870s, and by decade's end, production had soared to more than 80 million pounds, costing less than $2 per 100 pounds. The appearance of barbed wire carried profound significance for the plains, where little wood existed, and it benefited from the sales pitch of John Warren Bet a Million Gates, who trained a herd of docile steers and used them in his demonstrations. In fact, the wire worked as advertised. Wire did what innumerable judges, sheriffs, and even vigilantes could not. It secured the property rights of the small farmer against the cattle barons. And it took little to lay new wire if a farmer was fortunate enough to expand his holdings. In the short run, this forced the constant westward migration of the cattle drovers. In the long run, it probably secured the viability of large agricultural operations. Farming, milling, lumbering, mining, ranching, and harvesting of natural resources in the American West thus exhibited striking consistency. Small producers and entrepreneurs began the process, only to be superseded by large capitalized firms that could afford the technology necessary to efficiently harvest fur, fish, timber, ore, cattle, and foodstuffs. In so doing, they produced riches that benefited millions of Americans. The evidence shows that those who enjoyed government favors and subsidies abused the resources the most, whereas those who had to pay their own way proved the best conservators of our natural heritage. Ultimately, the story of the harvesting of natural resources in the West is far from a tragic one. Rather, it is a story of transition and adjustment. The settlement and expansion of the Trans-Mississippi West exactly paralleled the rise of the Industrial Revolution and the subsequent decline of small producers and farmsteads in America toward the end of the 19th century, and reflected a growth in manufacturing. Without question, some of the generation that migrated west following the Civil War paid a hard price for modernity. Most never found their dream of a Western Eden. Yet in the long run, a great many of them found a level of independence and prosperity unheard of in Europe. Those who did adjust, and their children after them, reaped the many benefits the Industrial Revolution and modernity brought in increased standards of living and life expectancy. Only one group was largely left out of either the rising prosperity or the expanding political freedom in the West. The original inhabitants. The Indians' next to last stand. Since colonial times, interactions between whites and Indians had followed a remarkably similar pattern, regardless of the region in which those interactions took place. Upon first contact, Indians and non-Indians were often peaceful toward one another and made many important cross-cultural exchanges: food, language, religion, medicine, military techniques, and material culture, tools, weapons, clothing, and so forth. However, this initial peace was always followed by conflict over land, which would lead to a land treaty, and then more misunderstanding and anger, and eventually a war, which always ended in Indian defeat. This in turn resulted in either the extermination or expulsion farther west of native Indian peoples. By the time of the Civil War, nearly all Indians east of the Mississippi were either dead, buttoned up on small reservations, or pushed westward, where this same cycle of relations had started anew. Indians of the Trans-Mississippi West were diverse regional groups inhabiting the plains, Rocky Mountains, and the Pacific Coast. Relocated tribes, Eastern Indians, such as the Cherokee, Creek, Delaware, Shawnee, and Miami, occupied tracts of land directly west of the Mississippi or in the Oklahoma Indian Territory. Along the Pacific shore, from Alaska to Northern California, coastal Indians, Puyallup, Makah, Tlingit, Nisqually, Chinook, and so on, lived in abundance and created sophisticated art, architecture, religion, and material culture. In the southwestern mountains, Hopi and Navajo herded livestock and farmed corn. Neighboring Apache hunted and gathered on horseback like the vast majority of Columbia Plateau, Yakima, Spokane, and Nez Perce, and Great Plains Indians. The Great Plains Indians, located in between the relocated Indians and West Coast, Plateau, and Mountain tribes, constituted the most formidable barrier to white settlement. At one time, Plains Indians had been farmers. Introduction of the horse by Europeans literally transformed the world of the Plains tribes. Once they had the horse, hunting buffalo became much easier, turning the Indians into nomads who roamed the prairie in search of the herds. These herds, by any assessment, were vast at the time the first whites encountered them. Colonel Richard Dodge wrote in 1871 that the whole country appeared one mass of buffalo, an observation similar to that by Thomas Farnham in 1839 on the Santa Fe Trail, when he watched a single herd cross his line of sight for 3 days. To say that the animals covered the interior of America is not much of an exaggeration. They did not last long, however. Even before the introduction of the horse, Indians had hunted bison, though not nearly as effectively. They tracked herds on foot, often setting fire to the grasslands in a massive box surrounding a herd, except for a small opening through which the panicked animals ran, and were slaughtered by the hundreds. Frequently, though not universally, Indians destroyed entire herds, using fire or running them off cliffs. One Indian spiritual belief held that if a single animal escaped, it would warn all other animals in the region, and other Indian concepts of animals viewed the animal population as essentially infinite, supplied by the gods. Eco-historians agree that although hunting by the Plains Indians alone did not threaten the bison with extinction, when combined with other natural factors, including fire and predators, Indian hunting may have put the buffalo on the road to extinction over time, regardless of the subsequent devastating impact of white hunters. The fatal weakness of the Plains nomads regarding the buffalo was expressed by traveler John McDougall when he wrote of the Blackfeet in 1865, "Without the buffalo they would be helpless, and yet the whole nation did not own one." The crucial point is that the Indians did not herd and breed the very animal they depended on. No system of surplus accumulation existed. Since the entire source of wealth could rot and degrade, none could exist for long. Moreover, the nomadic life made it impossible to haul much baggage, and therefore personal property could not be accumulated. This led fur trader Edwin Denig to conclude that this deficiency prevented the plains nomads from storing provisions and made them utterly dependent on European trade goods. A great eco-myth has appeared, however, about the Indians and their relationship with the buffalo, wherein Indians were portrayed as the first true ecologists and environmentalists. Nothing could be further from the truth. Traveler after traveler reported seeing herds of rotting carcasses in the sun, often with only a hump or tongue gone. While the bison was, as Tom McHugh claimed, a tribal department store, with horns used for arrows, intestines for containers, skins and hides for teepee coverings and shields, and muscle for ropes, it is misleading to suggest that Indians did not wantonly slaughter buffalo at times. Father Pierre de Smet observed an Assiniboine hunt in which 2,000 to 3,000 Indians surrounded an entire herd of 600 bison and killed every one. Aside from their own deprivation, which they could only notice when it was too late to prevent, the Indians had no way of estimating or tracking the size and health of the herds, and even if they could, nomadic lifestyle made it difficult to enforce the mandates against waste. It is also meaningless to employ terms like ecological imperialism to describe the interaction of the Europeans and the Indians. People of different races and ethnic backgrounds had come into contact with each other globally for centuries, from the Chinese in Southeast Asia to the Mongols in Europe to the Arabs in Africa. Seeds, germs, animals, viruses, all have interacted incessantly around the world for eons. Even the European honeybee had settled as far west as St. Louis by the early 1700s. To invoke such language is an attempt to reattach blame to Columbus and capitalism after anthropologists and historians have discovered that North American Indians had choices in how their world was shaped and made no greater share of right or wrong choices than the new arrivals from Europe. Still, it is unarguable that once a market for buffalo hides, bones, and other parts developed, it paid white hunters to shoot every buffalo in sight, which they tended to do. It ironically turned the common teaching tool that the Indians used all of the buffalo, meaning they used all parts of the animal, but not at once, on its head. Now, industrialists indeed used almost the entirety of the animal for various products. By 1900, fewer than a couple of thousand buffalo remained, at which point the government sought to protect them on federal lands such as Yellowstone National Park, one of the first Maine refuges. Whatever the numbers, the elimination of the buffalo not only nearly exterminated a species, but it also further diminished the Plains Indians' ability to sustain themselves and pushed them into a lifestyle that made them much more likely to come into conflict with whites. Having become nomads following the herd, as opposed to landowners working farms, whatever concepts of property rights they had held vanished. So, too, disappeared any need for them to respect white property rights, no matter how questionably gained. After the nomadic culture overtook Plains Indian life, a new culture of hunting with an emphasis on weapons naturally infused their society. Ironically, the nomadic lifestyle at the same time protected the Plains tribes from diseases that ravaged more stationary eastern Indian tribes, although a few, such as the Assiniboine, picked up smallpox and other diseases in neighboring villages and carried them home. It took several encounters with European diseases before the Indians discovered that humans transmitted them. But by about 1800, the village Indians had been decimated by diseases, whereas the nomadic tribes were relatively untouched. Thus, not only had the transformation of Indian society by bison hunting actually saved many of the Indians from an early death, but some of the techniques they practiced on the buffalo, riding and shooting, maneuvering, teamwork, also proved valuable in a challenge of a different sort, their wars against the American soldiers. In battle, these Plains Indians could be fierce warriors. They fought while galloping at full speed, dropping and rising at will, and using their horses as shields. This combination of phenomenal horsemanship and skilled marksmanship, with bow, spear, and repeating carbine rifle, proved deadly. Ultimately, the U.S. government would expend significant resources, several $100,000 for each one of these fierce, courageous people killed, merely exposing the complex and often contradictory problems inherent in federal Indian policy. In the Snake Indian Wars from 1864 to 1868, about 2,500 California soldiers, scouts, and volunteers defeated the Indians, killing 990 against 168 white losses. Massacres such as Little Bighorn and Fetterman were precisely that, isolated events set against a backdrop of the Western way of war employed against an Aboriginal people. Philosophically, American policymakers were divided into camps of preservationists, exterminationists, and assimilationists, with the latter two dominating policy debates. Preservationists, such as Helen Hunt Jackson, author of Century of Dishonor, 1885, were idealists who proposed simply leaving the Indians alone and free to roam the plains and continue their hunting and gathering lifestyle. Such romantics, of course, ignored violent Indian conquest and the documented expansion of such empires as the Lakota Sioux, who brutally smashed all opposition on the Great Plains. Equally unrealistic and less humane, intolerant exterminationists argued that preservation and assimilation were both impossible. Indians could never adjust to modernity, said exterminationists. They had to stand aside for progress because their day was done. According to this essentially racist view, any Indians who violently resisted reservation confinement should be killed, a sentiment that supposedly originated with General Philip Sheridan, who had allegedly said, "The only good Indians I ever saw were dead." In fact, Sheridan, as commander of the Division of the Missouri, supervised many reservations and thought it important to the protection of the Indians to keep them on the agency lands, lest the whites kill them. Reality was that the closer one got to the frontier, the more likely one was to see such sentiments expressed. "Cleanse the plains," roared the Nebraska City Press, and "exterminate the whole fraternity of Redskins." Whereas the Montana Post called notions of civilizing the Indians sickly sentimentalism that should be consigned to novel writers. If the hostiles did not end their barbarities immediately, wipe them out, the paper intoned. Like his predecessor at the Division of the Missouri, General William Tecumseh Sherman, Sheridan had no qualms about ruthlessly punishing Indians who strayed off the reservation to commit atrocities, and he renewed efforts to enforce confinement of tribes on reservations. Certainly many soldiers who had lost comrades in battles with the Sioux or Cheyenne had no mercy for the Indian. "They must be hunted like wolves," Brigadier General Patrick Connor told Major General Grenville Dodge. The third group, the assimilationists, however, had a realistic view that industrialization and progress made the preservationist ideal impossible, but any effort to exterminate the natives was not only uncivilized and unchristian, but also unconstitutional. Assimilationists argued that Indians must be put on reservations and cured of their nomadic ways for their own protection. The tribes had to learn English, embrace Christianity, and adopt the farming and ranching techniques of whites in the hope that they or their children might one day become working men and women in mainstream American civilization. This reservation system was the only alternative to extinction, but it destroyed Indian culture as effectively as any military campaign, as critics rightly charged. A glaring weakness in the assimilationist position lay in the fact that many of the so-called civilized tribes, like the Cherokee, had already been forced off their lands anyway, regardless of their level of civilization. While the assimilationist views finally prevailed, exterminationist voices remained loud in the halls of Congress, and at times federal strategy for dealing with the Indians incorporated all three viewpoints. Almost everyone, Indian and white alike, would have agreed that the approach to the Indians was confusing and contradictory. "Our whole Indian policy," wrote the editor of The Nation magazine in 1865, "is a system of mismanagement and in many parts one of gigantic abuse." In many ways, that policy only reflected the irreconcilable differences among these three strategies for dealing with the Native Americans. And although the task of moving nomadic, warlike Indian people onto reservations without incident was, in retrospect, nearly impossible, the government nevertheless committed avoidable errors. At the root of the problems with establishing any coherent Indian policy lay a conflict of interest between the two federal agencies authorized to deal with the tribes, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, BIA, and the U.S. Army. The BIA reported to Congress, drafted Indian policy, and staffed the Indian reservation bureaucracy. The BIA planned for, governed, fed, clothed, medicated, and educated the nomads of the plains. Created in 1824 as the Indian Bureau of the Department of War, Congress moved the agency to the newly created Interior Department in 1849. Civilian departments, which relied far less on merit than the military, by their nature spawned a thoroughgoing corruption. Christian denominations administered some agencies under the Grant administration, and certainly they were not free from corruption either. But many other reservations landed in the hands of political hacks with get-rich-quick schemes to defraud the natives. The illegal sale of supplies, blankets, and food designated for the Indians not only deprived the tribes of necessities, but also provoked them to aggression that otherwise might have been prevented. The other federal agency, the U.S. Army, was charged with rounding up the Indians, relocating them to their respective reservations, keeping them there if they tried to leave, and defeating them if they fought. Thus, the Army emerged as the enforcement arm of BIA policy, which was a bad arrangement under any circumstance. Frontier military forces were heavy on cavalry and infantry, and light on artillery, as dictated by the fighting style of their enemy. Other non-traditional elements soon characterized the frontier military, including scout units of Crow and other Indians, often dressed in uniform, assigned to every command. Then there were the Buffalo Soldiers, companies of African-American troops whom the Indians thought had hair like bison. Stationed with the 10th Cavalry and other regiments, the black soldiers greatly troubled the Indians, although the most interrogators could learn from Native American captives was that, "Buffalo soldier no good, heap bad medicine." Despite its differences from previous armies, the U.S. Army on the frontier still had a simple mission: to engage and destroy any enemies of the United States. Fighting against the Western way of war, the natives could not win. The Native American style of war resembled the failed traditions of the Muslims at Tours or the Egyptians at the Battle of the Pyramids. It featured hit-and-run tactics, individual melee combat, personal courage in order to attain battlefield honor, as opposed to unit cohesion, and largely unsynchronized attacks. Since most Army commanders were in the exterminationist camp and most of the BIA officers espoused assimilation, there was bound to be confusion and violence. Sherman described the disconcerting tension exacted on the Indians by the policies as a double process of peace within their reservation and war without. Even before the conclusion of the Civil War, this double process began to take shape on the Great Plains, and it would conclude with some of the most shocking U.S. cavalry defeats in the entire frontier period. Sand Creek and Yellowhair. Four major Indian wars ended once and for all the cycle of death that had characterized white Indian contact for more than 250 years. The first, from 1864 to 1865, occurred when Cheyenne and Arapaho warriors fiercely battled U.S. troops in Colorado. During the summer of 1864, Cheyenne Chief Black Kettle led assaults on white miners, farm settlers, and travelers, but weary of fighting, he surrendered in November. Black Kettle accepted a tribal land outside Pueblo, Colorado, and raised an American flag outside his tent, only to see his men, women, and children massacred by drunken Colorado militiamen, not U.S. regulars, in a sneak attack on November 28th at Sand Creek. One witness later testified that in this infamous Sand Creek massacre, Indians were scalped, their brains knocked out, the men used their knives, ripped open women, clubbed little children, knocked them in the head with their guns, and mutilated their bodies in every sense of the word. Fighting resumed until the fall of 1865, when again the Cheyenne agreed to go to a permanent reservation. Farther north, the mighty Lakota Sioux also resisted white incursions. Their struggle began in 1862-63 in Minnesota, a theater of the war that ended when U.S. Army General John Pope achieved victory and hanged 38 Sioux warriors as punishment. Farther west in 1866, Lieutenant Colonel William J. Fetterman, who had once boasted that he could ride through the whole Sioux Nation with 80 men, was leading a detachment of 80 men, ironically, to the relief of a wood-gathering train when a party of Oglala Sioux led by Red Cloud and including a young warrior named Crazy Horse annihilated his command in a precursor to the Custer Massacre. To anyone paying attention, the signs at the Fetterman debacle were ominous. Tribes that had scarcely gotten along in the past and that controlled different regions of the plains, Sioux, Cheyenne, and Arapaho, had simultaneously begun to resist and to do so over vast expanses of territory. Yet during the 20-minute Fetterman slaughter, two civilians wielding 16-shot Henry repeaters accounted for dozens of Sioux casualties. Had the Sioux appreciated the lethality of rapid-fire weapons, they would have known that even a moderate advantage in numbers would not be sufficient against similarly armed, well-disciplined bluecoats. For example, in August 1867, just 31 soldiers with a woodcutting party, armed with newer breech-loading rifles and protected by a circle of wagons, fought off nearly 2,000 Sioux and inflicted 180 casualties. 2 years after the destruction of the Fetterman party, Sioux attacked engineers constructing a road to Fort Bozeman in Montana. Red Cloud, by then a leading Sioux warrior, had led the incursions, but Army counterattacks and subsequent promises to cease construction of the road persuaded him to retire to a Sioux reservation in the Dakotas. Following further incidents of corruption at the reservation agency, where delay in the delivery of food and supplies further antagonized the Sioux, they again bolted the reservation and renewed hostilities. By that time, a more or less constant state of war existed on the plains, with one tribe or another constantly menacing or being menaced by the army. From 1868 to 1874 in the Southwest, Kiowa, Comanche, Arapaho, and Cheyenne all engaged in a series of battles against military units. Despite the number of engagements, Indians still had failed to act in concert on a large scale, allowing the army to achieve tactical superiority and feeding its overconfidence. All this changed in June 1875. Northern Cheyenne and Sioux were once again driven to warfare by fresh white encroachments on their land. A gold rush in the Black Hills of South Dakota combined with the arrival there of the Northern Pacific Railroad to spark renewed warfare. Making matters worse in this case, the Sioux viewed the Dakota Black Hills as sacred ground, and they considered any white intrusion an act of sacrilegious trespass. Sioux leaders Sitting Bull, the diplomat father figure, and Crazy Horse, the cunning, eccentric tactician, assembled a substantial and impressive collection of tribes who reluctantly left the reservation to once again fight American soldiers. Acting as commander-in-chief, Sitting Bull planned the strategy. Crazy Horse, whose bravery none questioned, was one of the few Indians to perceive that the Western way of war had powerful, even insurmountable, advantages. He was the only Indian observed by soldiers to dismount in order to fire his rifle, and while still a young man, he had forsaken scalping. The army knew the tribes had gathered at a general location below the Yellowstone River and its Bighorn River tributary in what is southeastern Montana. Commanding General Sheridan devised a plan to pincer the Indians south of the Yellowstone between a three-pronged American force. From the south, General George Crook would move from Wyoming Territory. From western Montana, Colonel John Gibbon would march with his men eastward along the Yellowstone River. And a third force under General Alfred Terry, supported by the entire 7th Cavalry, would attack from the Dakotas. Since no one knew exactly where the Indians were encamped in June of 1876, the Army's elaborate plan immediately began to unravel when Indians attempted to engage each wing separately. Crook was beaten in mid-June and returned to base. In late June, to find the Sioux, Terry dispatched Colonel George Custer and nearly 700 cavalry. Custer, who as a Civil War hero had once held the wartime rank of Brigadier General, wanted to reclaim both his former rank and glory. Attired in his famous buckskin coat with his golden locks flowing, the colonel cut a dashing figure. His wife, Elizabeth Bacon Libby Custer, assumed the role of his official publicist, subtly massaging the record of events in Custer's career to present him as the gallant hero at all times. Indians knew him as Son of the Morning Star, or Yellow Hair, and he had impressed them in previous battles as fearless. Regular army commanders had a different opinion, considering him reckless and undisciplined. One time he rode alone into an Indian encampment to free two white female hostages. Another time he'd been court-martialed for leaving his post and abusing his troops in order to return home to see his Libby. For all his experience on the plains, Custer grossly underestimated the size, capabilities, and leadership of the combined Sioux-Cheyenne forces arrayed against him. Against all established military doctrine, he divided his cavalry regiment into four parts, three roughly equal units commanded by himself, Major Marcus Reno, and Captain Frederick Benteen, and a small pack train, and personally led five troops of 265 men to their doom on June 25, 1876. Despite Hollywood's subsequent depictions, the engagement had little drama. Most accounts, including recent archaeological mapping of cartridges and body placement, suggest the shooting from Custer's Ridge was over in less than 20 minutes. Reno's men, farther behind the main column, survived only by fleeing to a hill and digging in. There they were reinforced by the 3rd detachment of troops and the pack train. The Sioux had apparently done what no other Native Americans ever had by beating the regular U.S. Army in a head-to-head contest, although to do so required that Custer not only divide his force four ways, but string it out along a front several miles as well. When the excited chiefs told Sitting Bull of their overwhelming victory, he reportedly noted that the white man was as numerous as the leaves on the trees, and he commanded the village to pack up and withdraw before Terry's main body arrived. The old adage about winning the battle but losing the war is most applicable in the case of Custer's last battle. Word of Little Bighorn arrived in Washington just as the nation was preparing to celebrate the 100-year anniversary of the American Revolution. Despite his many personal and professional flaws, Americans immediately embraced George Armstrong Custer as a martyr for the cause of American Manifest Destiny and sought to avenge his slaying. A mere 4 months after the Battle of Little Bighorn, Sioux and Northern Cheyenne stood defeated, and they surrendered once and for all. On October 31, 1876, a new treaty sent the Sioux back to their Dakota reservation, ending the Plains Indian Wars. One more tragic and perversely paradoxical saga was to unfold. By 1890, the Sioux had been thoroughly demoralized. In this state of mind, they turned to spiritualism in the form of the cult of the ghost dance, performed in the desperate belief that dancing would banish the white men, return Indian lands, and make Indians invulnerable to bullets and cannons. Military governors, alarmed at the wild mysticism of the ghost dancers, ordered them to stop and ominously sent in the 7th Cavalry to make them desist. 2 weeks earlier, the Indian agency had attempted to arrest Sitting Bull for supporting the ghost dancers, and in the process a gun battle broke out and the chief was killed, along with a dozen of his bodyguards and police. On December 29, 1890, troops bungled their attempt to disarm the Sioux at Wounded Knee, site of the Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. In sub-zero temperatures, shooting broke out, although both white and Indian witnesses disagreed over who started the firing. Some ghost dancers hid guns beneath their blankets, but most Indians were not armed. Regardless, popularly viewed as a cold-blooded massacre, some 200 Sioux men, women, and children lay dead in the snow. The army lost 25 killed and 39 wounded. Wounded Knee marked another dark episode in the treatment of the Indians. By then, however, the government had already concluded that the reservation system was not working, leading to yet another direction in American Indian policy. To the southwest, from 1851 to 1886, the Apaches staged a long-running intermittent resistance to white settlement. Apache Indians populated land from New Mexico to Southern California and even reached into Oklahoma. Under Mangus Coloradus, the Apache fought in southern Texas and New Mexico, and after being wounded, Mangus met with Brigadier General Joseph West in 1863 to negotiate a truce. Instead, he was taken into custody, tortured, and shot. In 1861, the son-in-law of Mangus, Cochise, was imprisoned near Apache Pass in Arizona. After he escaped, he took hostages of his own and murdered them, and the incidents provoked a new round of warfare. Cochise fought and raided until 1872, when he agreed to a treaty and moved to a reservation. He died there in 1874. A third Apache leader, the famous Geronimo, engaged in guerrilla strikes for many years before being captured in 1877. He escaped, fled to Mexico, and ultimately found himself pursued by a massive force of 5,000 U.S. soldiers, 500 Apache scouts, 100 Navajo scouts, and thousands of civilian militia under General Nelson Miles. Persuaded to surrender, Geronimo was imprisoned. Though late in life, as a celebrity, he was allowed to make appearances at the 1904 World's Fair and rode in President Theodore Roosevelt's 1905 inauguration parade, all the while technically a prisoner. He embraced Christianity late in life, joining the Dutch Reformed Church, and died at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, of natural causes in 1909 as one of the most famous symbols of Indian resistance to white dominance of the West. The final stages of assimilation. The assimilation movement had gained momentum 3 years before Wounded Knee with passage of the Dawes-Severalty Act, 1887, wherein Indian reservations, with some exceptions, were divided into approximately 160-acre plots for male family heads, with lesser amounts to individuals. Indians had 4 years to select their land, after which the selection was made for them by the agent. supported strongly by President Grover Cleveland, who saw the government as a guardian to the wards of the state, the Dawes Act reflected Cleveland's personal views of the Indians, which swung from lazy, vicious, and stupid to industrious, peaceful, and intelligent. Along with other reformers who saw the Indians as needing guidance, but who also agreed that barbarism and civilization cannot live together, Cleveland preferred a process of civic and cultural instruction in which the Native Americans would learn English in government schools and gradually attain all the formal conventions of citizenship. In the Dawes Act, Congress also sought to move Native Americans away from the tribal system and fully into the market economy by making them landowners. But as with most dealings with the Indians, there were also ulterior, less noble motives. Any unclaimed lands went on the open land market, which whites snapped up. But the purpose of Dawes was not to steal land, although that certainly happened, but to change the tribal organization and habits of the Indians. Supporters called it the Emancipation Proclamation for the Indians, and the Friends of the Indian, Eastern religious leaders and humanitarians, also embraced the legislation. The gap between where the Indians were and where they needed to be in order to fully function in a market economy, however, was too great. Over the next decades, generations of Plains Indians born to reservation life fared little better than those who had openly fought U.S. soldiers. Alcoholism, high infant mortality, and poverty characterized the generation of Indians who struggled to make the transition from nomadic life to modernity. Congress finally gave up on the Dawes Act in the 1930s, by which time many Indians had lost their land, although others had doggedly survived and, in some cases, managed to flourish. From 1929 to 1933, Charles Curtis, a member of Kansas' Kaw Indian tribe through his mother's ancestry, served as Herbert Hoover's vice president. And in 1934, the so-called Indian New Deal allowed for the creation of reservation self-governance through tribal councils. Yet change came painfully slowly. Not until the middle of the 20th century did the lives of a significant number of Indians improve. Grandchildren and great-grandchildren of the brave Plains warriors fought with distinction as American soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in World Wars I and II, the Korean War, Vietnam, and the Gulf and Iraq Wars. Perhaps the most famous was one of the flag raisers on Iwo Jima's Mount Suribachi, Ira Hayes. Indians learned to speak English, embraced both Protestant and Catholic Christianity, and slowly began to assimilate into mainstream culture. Problems persisted, but by the late 20th century, individual American Indians enjoyed success on almost every social, political, and economic front. By that time, after three centuries of depopulation, Indians finally began to see their numbers increase. Alcoholism abated somewhat, and with that, so too did infant mortality rates and fetal alcohol syndrome. Tribal elementary and secondary schools ultimately spawned tribal colleges. Many Indians left to attend state and private colleges and universities. Native American politicians entered government, rising as high as Vice President Curtis and Colorado Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell. Some Indians earned law degrees and returned home to file suit and win enforcement of Indian treaty rights, including fishing, in state and federal courts. Others formed tribal corporations and harvested their reservations' natural resources, timber, ore, oil, agriculture, and fish, to vastly increase their per capita income and standard of living. Others hunted in the most fertile new grounds, the tourism market, building hunting lodges, museums, and gambling casinos to mine an increasing number of non-Indians who yearned to visit and experience Indian country. Success, however, remained a relative term when describing efforts to move Native Americans into the market economy, Many reservations have unemployment rates of over 40%. In light of these challenges, perhaps the greatest story of Native American assimilation and achievement has been that of the Mississippi Choctaw under the leadership of Chief Philip Martin. In 1975, Martin determined that the tribe's future lay in attracting private enterprise, and he convinced the tribal council to give him nearly absolute power to negotiate contracts, to enforce work rules, and to make the Choctaw Reservation as competitive as any place in the private sector. Using government guarantees and a couple of small federal grants, Martin constructed the infrastructure for a business park, roads, sewage, water, and other facilities. Then the tribe sent out 150 advertising packages to companies. General Motors responded, contracting the Choctaw to assemble wire harnesses for electrical parts, requiring Martin's agreement that the Indians perform as well as any white company. He dealt with employees firmly and even ruthlessly. No tardiness, no sloppy dress, and above all, perfect workmanship. Soon, a greeting card company, then Ford, then other companies began moving into Choctaw land, and Martin's positions were vindicated. Ford gave the tribe a quality performance award, and unemployment, which had reached 75% before Chief Martin took control, dipped to under 20%, a level high by white standards, but amazingly low for an Indian reservation. By 1993, the Choctaw Indian tribe was the 10th largest employer in the state of Mississippi. The Choctaw notwithstanding, it would be unwise to declare a happy ending to a 400-year history of warfare, abuse, theft, and treachery by whites, and of suffering by Indians. Yet it is absolutely correct to say that the end result of Indian-white cross-acculturation has been a certain level of assimilation, an aim that had once seemed hopeless. Modern Indians are proud Americans who simultaneously embrace their Indian ethnicity and folk traditions, Christianity, Western legal traditions, capitalism, and all facets of mainstream American civilization. But getting there has been a difficult, bloody, and tragic struggle. Territorial government and statehood. The specific conditions under which the Western territories were to become states was only generally addressed in the federal Constitution in Article 3, Section 4. Beginning with the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, a series of organic acts, as they were called, set down the rules whereby frontiersmen could gain equal citizenship in the United States of America. Westerners often grew disgruntled under the rule of federally appointed territorial officials and what they saw as inordinately long territorial periods. A variety of factors weighted the length of time it took a territory to become a state. American domestic politics, foreign policy, and even social mores and religion played a role. Although most of the Western states had joined the Union by 1912, it was not until 1958 and 1959 that Alaska and Hawaii at last completed their journeys through the territorial process. Territories west of the Mississippi slowly became states in the Union before the Civil War because of the politics of slavery. Louisiana, 1812, Texas, 1845, and California, 1850, entered under special agreements tied to American foreign policy. The remaining territories, like Oregon and Nevada, which became states in 1859 and 1864, respectively, fell under organic acts resembling the Northwest and Southwest Ordinances of 1787 and 1789. By the late 19th century, nearly all of the Western territories had reached the requisite population necessary for admission to the Union. But, as before, political complications characterized their attempts to achieve statehood. Washington, for example, was denied statehood for years by Democrats who mustered enough votes to thwart its admission to the Union. Finally, in 1889, Grover Cleveland signed the famed Omnibus Bill, which simultaneously admitted Washington, Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota as full-fledged states in the Union. Idaho and Wyoming followed as states in 1890. Like that of other territories, the early history of Washington was dominated by political bickering between Whigs and Republicans and Democrats and a strong territorial governor, Isaac Ingalls Stevens. A lifelong Democrat and West Point engineering graduate, Stevens represented the best and worst of the territorial system. He was intelligent, efficient, and tireless, and he left an indelible legacy of strong territorial government, a railroad, and a vast Indian reservation complex in the Pacific Northwest. But he ruled with an iron hand. Stevens's authoritarianism is exemplified by the fact that, during his 1853-57 term of duty, he served simultaneously as territorial governor, federal Indian superintendent, federal Indian treaty negotiator, and U.S. Army surveyor for the Northern Transcontinental Railroad. With this kind of authority and conflicts of interests, Stevens engaged in an aggressive Indian policy to make way for what he sincerely viewed as God-ordained white progression onto Indian lands. Unlike Washingtonians and Idahoans, Mormon Utahans usually voted as Democrats in the 19th century. Yet this affiliation did not win them any friends in Congress, where their religious beliefs were unacceptable to nearly all non-Mormon, Gentile Americans. The main stumbling block was the Mormon practice of polygamy, and the Mormons' detractors vowed that Utah would remain a territory and that Mormons would be denied citizenship as long as they continued to practice this belief. Initially, Mormons had sought to entirely escape the laws of the United States by establishing independence in Mexican territory. When Americans won Utah in the Mexican-American War, the newly arrived Mormons ignored and resisted territorial government in favor of their own theocracy led by Brigham Young. In 1857, President Buchanan sent General Albert Sidney Johnston and 2,500 Army cavalry troops to enforce U.S. sovereignty in the famed and bloodless Mormon War. In 1858, through a negotiator, Young reached an agreement with Buchanan in which the church would recognize the United States as sovereign in all temporal matters, whereas the Mormon church would have spiritual authority over its members. This amounted to little more than the old arrangements under which the popes and kings in Europe had operated for hundreds of years. Soon thereafter, the Mormons accepted Buchanan's territorial governor, Alfred Cumming. Matters were not fully resolved, however. In 1862, Congress passed the Moral Anti-Bigamy Act, abolishing plural marriage and disallowing Mormon church assets over $50,000. The moral law raised constitutional issues that Mormons fought out all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Losing in court, some Mormons, a small percentage actually, continued to practice polygamy in direct defiance of federal authority. Finally, the Edmonds Act of 1882 denied the vote and other constitutional rights to all polygamists. Moreover, it declared any children born into polygamous families after 1883 to be illegitimate without the legal right of inheritance, which would have obliterated the Mormons' coveted family structure and stripped Mormons of all their assets. They challenged the Edmonds Act in the Supreme Court case of Romney v. United States, 1889, but lost again, at which point the Mormons at last surrendered and officially renounced plural marriage. Soon thereafter, in 1896, Congress admitted Utah as the 46th state. New Mexico and Arizona, whose populations had lagged far behind Utah and the other western states, followed in 1912. Thus, by the early 20th century, all of the territories in the contiguous portions of America had achieved statehood. Yet westward expansion and the territorial and statehood systems also included Alaska and Hawaii. Alaska became a U.S. possession, though not a territory, in 1867, when William Seward, the Secretary of State, negotiated to purchase all Russian claims north of 54 degrees latitude for a mere $7.2 million. This figure seems cheap today, but at that time, Seward's foes labeled the purchase of this icy acreage an act of lunacy. Hawaii followed in 1893, when American settlers overthrew Queen Liliuokalani and established a provisional government, which the United States recognized. Congress had coveted the Hawaiian Islands for several years, and the islands had been populated and influenced by a large number of Americans. But business, specifically the North American sugar industry, which feared the competition, opposed annexation. However, the new president, William McKinley, supported expansion, and an annexation resolution passed Congress in 1898. 2 years later, Congress created the Hawaii Territory, mainly with an eye for use as a coaling station for the new Blue Water Navy that the nation had started to construct. Although virtually no one saw the Far East as being of much importance in American security issues, the Spanish-American War had left the United States in control of Guam and the Philippines, creating a vast operating space for warships attempting to operate out of West Coast bases. In keeping with the naval doctrines of Alfred Thayer Mahan, the projection of seaborne forces at long distances was crucial, and therefore so was their refueling and supply. Hawaii, with its wonderful natural harbor, fit the bill. Alaska's legal limbo from 1867 to 1912, being neither territory nor state, only exacerbated the natural animosity colonial Americans had always felt toward the federal government. Gold rushes in the Klondike and Nome from 1896 to 1900 brought more people north, 20,000 in the new city of Nome alone by 1900, who established some 50 new mining camp cities in a 10-year stretch. Even though the growing population led to territorial status, Alaska's geographic isolation and low European-American population made its wait for statehood the longest of any American territory. The Alaska Railroad was built by 1923, in the process leading to the founding of Anchorage, the largest city in Alaska. Such enterprises helped, but World War II proved to be the turning point. The Japanese invasion of the Aleutian Islands prompted a strong U.S. military presence in Alaska, which in turn resulted in the long-awaited completion of the Alaska Highway. The Alcan, as it was called, connected the continental United States and Alaska year-round via a road spanning the Canadian province of British Columbia and the Yukon Territory. Meanwhile, Japan's 1941 surprise attack on Pearl Harbor brought a substantial military force to the Hawaiian Islands and simultaneously propelled that territory's efforts to achieve statehood. Congress made Alaska the 49th state in 1959, and Hawaii followed later that year. Alaskan and Hawaiian statehood temporarily ended the territorial story, but not for long. Debates over the territorial system continue today in Puerto Rico and other Caribbean and Pacific regions annexed by Americans during their 19th century expansion under Manifest Destiny. And periodically, the issue of statehood for the District of Columbia surfaces. Long before Alaska and Hawaii completed the final jigsaw that is the map of the modern United States, however, the West, as a concept, had come to an end. Barbed wire, railroads, and eventually the invisible strands of American civilization made the West America and America the West. Prairie populism and national radicalism. Despite abundant opportunities on the frontier, the fact was that life in the West, especially on the plains, was hard. For every miner who hit pay dirt, 10 abandoned their claims and found other work. For every farmer who managed a successful homestead, several gave up and returned east. and for every cattle rancher who nurtured his herds into large holdings, dozens sold out and gave up. There was nothing new about this except the setting, the West. Yet for the first time, significant numbers of Westerners found allies in other sections of the country, people who shared their frustrations with the same economic trends. Miners, farmers, and laborers alike grew discontented in the late 19th century, often for different reasons. In mining, fishing, logging, and sawmill towns, capitalism's creative destruction process caused tumultuous change, with economic panics causing unemployment rates to twice rise as high as 30%. Wage earners complained of low salaries and dangerous working conditions, which led to the formation of labor unions, not a few of which were steeped in violence and socialism. But even in the countryside, Western farmers were growing angry over low crop prices, high railroad rates, and competition from agribusiness, expressing the sentiments of producers everywhere who found that they simply did not produce enough value for their fellow man. This realization, whether in the English spinning industry of the 1830s or the American auto industry of the 1980s, is difficult, especially for those falling behind. It did not, however, change the reality of the situation. With the availability of homestead lands and the opening of the new territories, the number of farms exploded. There were simply too many farmers in America. They, too, protested, but used the ballot, not the bullet. A set of laws known as the Granger Laws, named for the farm network the Grangers, or the Patrons of Husbandry, began to take effect in the 1870s. Attempting to control railroad and grain elevator prices, maintain competition, and forestall consolidation, the Grangers achieved their greatest victory in 1876 with Munn versus Illinois, a case involving a grain elevator operator's fees. The U.S. Supreme Court laid down an alarming doctrine that private property in which the public has an interest must submit to public controls. Under such reasoning, virtually any enterprise ever open to the public became the business of the government. A legal rendering that, to a large degree, stood the Constitution's property clause on its head. Fortunately, capitalism succeeded in spite of these reforms, producing so much wealth that most working people prospered and industry expanded, no matter what stifling regulatory barriers the growing federal and state bureaucracies threw up. In Western towns, as in the countryside, there was discontent. As in all emerging capitalist economies, the first generation of industrial laborers bore the brunt of rapid change. Many of them were recent immigrants, radicalized in Europe with no fondness for capitalism. They worked, on average, 60 hours per week, with skilled laborers earning 20 cents an hour, while unskilled earned half that, although these numbers could vary widely depending on industry and region. Dangerous work in industries like logging, mining, and fishing offered no job security, unemployment compensation, medical insurance, or retirement pensions, nor frequently did even minimal safety standards exist. Moreover, laborers were not free to bargain with business owners over wages and work conditions because government stacked the deck against them. Federal and state politicians outlawed union membership, issued court injunctions to halt strikes and cripple labor activism, and sent in federal and state government troops to protect the interests of powerful businessmen. Those who tried to improve their status by forming labor unions, often in violation of local anti-union laws, found that America's prosperity worked against them by attracting non-union immigrants who leaped at the opportunity to receive wages considered too low by union members. An early response to the issue of low wages came from the Knights of Labor, an organization originally formed in Philadelphia in 1869, which moved west in the 1880s. The Knights sought equity in the workplace, but only for white workers. They were noted for their opposition to Chinese and African American workers. Chinese worked for wages below those knights of labor demanded, and so the knights, shouting, "The Chinese must go," violently expelled the entire Chinese population, 700, of Tacoma, Washington, in November of 1885. Later, when African-American coal miners crossed the Knights' picket lines in Roslyn, Washington, the Knights again resorted to violence. In the end, however, the black strikebreakers and the coal company won the day, but it was a typical union response toward minorities that held sway well into the 1960s. More radical than the Knights of Labor were the Western Federation of Miners, WFM, and the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, the Wobblies. These groups took labor violence to new heights, in the process severely damaging the collective bargaining cause. Under the leadership of Ed Boyce in Kellogg, Idaho, the WFM stole a train, loaded it with dynamite, and blew up $1 million worth of the mine owner's infrastructure. Wobblies, on the other hand, started out peacefully. Led by Big Bill Haywood, they published pamphlets, made speeches, and filled the Spokane, Washington jail in peaceful acts of civil disobedience. Ultimately, however, the Wobblies gained fame, or infamy, depending on one's view, in violent imbroglios known as the Everett and Centralia massacres of the World War I era. But both these unions were exceptions that proved the rule. In the main, Western laborers and their unions had legitimate grievances they tried to address through the existing political system. Although saddled with unfair governmental restraints, they worked with Western governors, judges, and legislators for peaceful change. Political activism, combined with the prosperity of the capitalist system, eventually brought them the improved wealth and lifestyle they sought, in the process undercutting their very reason for existence. It presented a dilemma for leaders of the union movements, just as similar circumstances would present a difficult problem for civil rights and union leaders in the 1980s and 1990s. What do you do when, to a large degree, you have achieved your ends? The leader must either find or create new problems that need to be resolved, or admit there is no longer a purpose for him or the organization. Meanwhile, Republican political institutions addressed the complaints of the farmers and laborers with limited success through populist and progressive political movements, both of which aimed at harnessing capitalism to protect working people from its perceived dangers. While they did affect changes in laws, whatever gains they achieved in the courts often were illusory. There is no way to mandate higher pay or greater wealth for any group. Like the mine workers, many Western farmers perceived that they were on the outside looking in at the prosperity of the Industrial Revolution. Just as the small artisans and weavers of the 1820s had been overtaken